From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Senators John McCain and Barack Obama are now racing for the finish line. They've wrapped their third and final debate of election 2008. Last night's matchup had some very confrontational moments.
Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago.
Essentially, what you are proposing is 8 more years of the same thing, and it hasn't worked. And I think the American people understand it hasn't worked. We need to move in a new direction.
Here for some post-debate analysis is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So, how did things stack up last night overall?
I think they stacked up as the most effective debate, perhaps, for both candidates for highly different reasons. John McCain had his most effective night at taking the fight to Barack Obama, pushing him harder, looking at him, being more interactive with him, and bringing up some of the subjects that he has been pressed to bring up by some of his own core supporters. The William Ayers connection or alleged connection, the Acorn matter, Fannie and Freddie, some of the things that Republicans are upset about in this fall, this autumn of angst and unhappiness in America. And I thought it was also a pretty good night for Barack Obama because, once again, he kept that preternatural cool. He smiled. He even chuckled a few times. He parried the thrusts from John McCain, including the personal ones. And he seemed to emerge at the end of the night pretty comfortable with his own skin and his own lead.
Both of these men were seated extremely close to each other in a way that hadn't happened in the previous debates, and neither of them seemed entirely comfortable. There's much being made of their body language and their facial expressions. What did you see when you watched this?
Part of the problem, of course, is what you see on television is not exactly what's happening on stage. What you see on television is often the result of either a one-shot, where they show you one of the two men without the other, and you don't really have a sense of how close anyone else might be to him. And then there is the two-shot, the split screen, where you can actually watch the reactions on the faces of the candidate who isn't speaking. And that is a fairly interesting and sometimes devastating way to watch a debate. I think everyone recalls who saw the 2000 debates between George Bush and Al Gore that if you listened on radio or watched strictly the one shots, you got one impression. But if you saw the split screen, you saw Al Gore rolling his eyes and, you know, looking heavenward and making a lot of other gestures that people thought were disrespectful and maybe a little Bush league. That hurt, in that particular case, Al Gore more than it hurt George Bush. So in the debate last night, a lot of the two shots, a lot of those split screens showed John McCain looking angry, showed him looking very irritated, showed him looking upset and staring over at what appeared to be the next head just inches away, even though the two were seated on opposite sides of a rather large table.
When it comes down to issues, at this point, many people have already made up their minds based on either personality or issues, but did either of these two men strike out and forge new territory based on issues?
I wouldn't say that either of them really got into any terribly different territory. John McCain did explore some of those things that I mentioned a moment ago that he hasn't brought up in the debates. There was the use of the phrase class warfare by John McCain in reference to the phrase share the wealth, which was used by Barack Obama in a conversation with a now famous plumber in Ohio who has been referred to repeatedly as Joe the Plumber, although it turns out his actual name is Sam Wurzelbacher and not the name that John McCain gave for him last night.
I think Senator McCain also called him Wurzelberger.
There seems to be coming out about this individual today, but he was brought up as a symbol. And if there was any kind of new territory in all of that, it was using this man as a symbol for the Republican contention that if Barack Obama's going to raise anybody's taxes, he's going to raise taxes on you. He's going to raise taxes on the working class.
Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
That was NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, and he joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. We want to continue our post-debate analysis with Sherrilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, folks.
Hi. Hi, Farai.
So, Ron, many pundits said last night's debate was Senator McCain's last chance to change the trajectory of this race. Was that an accurate assessment, and how did he do, in your opinion?
Well, I don't think it was the last opportunity for him to change the trajectory of the race, but it was certainly one of the last opportunities that he could make the case before the entire American people, where everyone was watching him, to hear his vision, his ideology, and the direction that he'd like to take the country. And I think both Senator Obama and Senator McCain achieved what they needed to do last night. Senator McCain came across as less testy than he has in the past, and he came across as being particularly credible when he talked about economic issues, which has been something to the chagrin of many Republicans, that they haven't seen that fight and that vigor from him to talk in a straightforward manner. And I think Senator Obama did what he needed to do, which was to not get too ruffled and to not let Senator McCain get under his collar too much. So I think it was a good performance by both candidates last night.
Sherrilyn, what did you hear in terms of issues? What came up for you on the basis of how they stood on, say, abortion or the economy?
Well, it was interesting. Some of those issues were really touched on in some ways by the first time. I think that the whole issue of choice that came up at the end of the debate, and of course it's questionable how many people were still watching of undecided voters at that point, was an important moment, I think, in the debate. You know, this moment where John McCain, decried this idea of the health of the mother as being, almost this kind of strange, out-of-whack idea, even though it's an idea that actually is the Supreme Court's idea and is part of the law of the land under Roe versus Wade, I think for people would be an important moment, but would only be an important moment, for people, I think, who already are likely to not want to vote for the McCain-Palin ticket because they are pro-choice. And so in many ways, I think that, both of these candidates were shored up their base. Barack had less to do last night. He had to show up. He had to remain cool. He had to remain calm. He had to show that he was unafraid of these attacks that John McCain had been hinting he would bring to, Barack all week. And I think Barack definitely did that. For McCain, he had a bigger job to do. And I actually don't think, I think Ron is right. The word was performance. I don't think that anything that happened in the debate last night is likely to make or break this election. I think this election was pretty much decided 2 weeks ago when the financial crisis hit.
All right. I want to you bring up the confrontational issue, and I want to go to Senator McCain, who brought up William Ayers. He is the man who served on a board with Senator Obama and who was someone who was a domestic terrorist or domestic bomber and fairly unapologetic about it. But the question is, how close was Senator Obama to this man? Here's a bit of the exchange between Senator McCain and Obama.
Mr. Ayers, I don't care about an old washed-up terrorist, but as Senator Clinton said in her debates with you, we need to know the full extent of that relationship.
Mr. Ayers is not involved in my campaign. He has never been involved in this campaign, and he will not advise me in the White House.
Ron, when you look at the record, the fact that these two men were on the same board, a Walter Annenberg board. Walter Annenberg, of course, funding major journalism and communication schools with bipartisan boards. It's not the closest connection. Why is this a persistent issue?
Well, I think it's a question of character and it's a question of association. I mean, it is true that Annenberg had provided some nearly $60 million for grant authority, and that Senator Obama was the entity or one of the entities that was responsible for disbursing those funds, upon which Mr. Ayers was on the board. But if you look at a larger portfolio, it's William Ayers. It's looking at the Reverend Wright. First it was, he's my close spiritual pastor and minister, upon which he named one of his books after. And then it's, I haven't heard anything from those pews. And you go on down the line of the association that Senator Barack Obama has had with a number of Americans who some might say that they've had racist rhetoric in their past, or they might have had a domestic terrorism aspect to their past, or Franklin Rains and his association there. And you start to say, how many layers of the onion do you have to peel back before Senator Obama is more forthcoming? I will say, however, that I think that Sherrilyn's right. But look, I think the Ayers issue has been raised and has been articulated. This election is going to be decided on the economy. Senator McCain, if he's going to try to make up any ground, has got to close ground by talking about the economy and his economic vision. I think these associations will do more to hurt McCain at this point than help him. He's got to talk about the economy.
All right, Sherrilyn, I want to ask you about something that is related. It's this whole confrontation issue, but from a different cut. You've got Congressman John Lewis, mm-hmm. who made statements about Senator McCain, saying that essentially Senator McCain was inciting form of hatred that was very dangerous to Senator Obama's life, as well as, you know, any political issues. That came up. What did you make of that discussion?
Well, I have to tell you, it was a really powerful, powerful moment, I think, for a lot of listeners. I actually was rather surprised at Barack Obama's response, which, because I think it was missing one piece, which is that, you know, much like John McCain sits in a very particular position having been a prisoner of war, so too does John Lewis in American Life sit in a very particular position having been a victim of white supremacy and continuing to bear the physical and emotional scars of that. And so the whole idea that Barack Obama was now supposed to somehow rebuke John Lewis for his views of what he felt reminded him of a period that he lived through and experienced in a way that neither Barack Obama nor John McCain experienced was pretty shocking. And, you know, I think Barack Obama decided to handle it very calmly and very clearly. But what it did show by John McCain raising it is that contrary to what he said, he does care about, you know, Barack Obama's associations, because he doesn't, he's not able to make real traction on the economy, which is the issue that really is the loser for him. And so he does care about raising these issues. And so when he said, you know, his feelings were hurt, it was actually interesting, Barack Obama's response, which was that, you know, the voters don't care about our hurt feelings. And it was an interesting response. Because, of course, Obama could have cited John McCain's associations. He could have talked about Sarah Palin's husband, who's just been, you know, in a report listed as having, you know, exerted power, attempted to exert power to have her ex-brother-in-law fired, his association with the Alaska Independence Party. All of that could have been brought up, but Barack chose not to do it because he doesn't have to.
All right, we have to end it there. It's always good to end on a note of civil disagreement. So with that, thank you so much.
Thank you, Barack.
Thanks for joining, bud.
That was Sherrilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, of Christie Strategies and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Just ahead, we're going to talk about voting overseas. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Going to your local polling station and casting a ballot should be simple, but what if you're no longer living in the neighborhood you're registered in? For some people, that happens when they're deployed overseas by the military. Others choose to move, of course, and yet more are displaced domestically by natural disasters like Hurricane Ike. We're going to pick up our series on voting with a look at overseas and displaced voters. Joining us now is Mark Sawyer. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. Thanks for coming in the studios.
Thank you, Farai.
So voting in the U.S. can be complicated, but what's the process for voting in U.S. elections but from overseas?
Normally, people work that process out either with their state or through the embassy. One of the problems with voting in the U.S. is that we don't have any standard rules. Rules vary from state to state and locality to locality. So it's a veritable mishmash of rules, regulations that really don't have any consistency from one place to the next. So the advice is that each voter really needs to try and connect with their local registrar of voters or their county clerk or whoever handles elections and find out what they need to do in order to vote and do so as early as possible.
Now, how important is the overseas vote? That came up a lot in previous elections, you know, with President Bush and military ballots, for example, being an important factor. But this time around, do you think the overseas vote, military and non-military, is going to make a difference?
Any amount of votes can make a difference if a state is close. One of the things that's going on is that our voting systems have a substantial margin of error. And sometimes, like the 2000 election, the outcome is within that margin of error. And in that sense, then any votes, and particularly votes that we aren't quite clear on how to handle, like overseas votes, military votes that come in late, et cetera, raise doubts and questions about the nature of the election.
All right, Mark, we're going to bring in Susan Jaduszewska-Swina. She's the president of the Overseas Vote Foundation. It's a nonpartisan voter service for U.S. citizens living abroad. And she's in Munich, Germany. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for having me today.
So you've been overseas for 15 years. And how do you find the process of voting? I mean, is it easy? Is it hard?
Well, I'm not sure you know much about Overseas Vote Foundation. We actually have taken what is a federal program, the Overseas Voting Program is, run under the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, and there is a book of guidelines that's put out by the Federal Voting Assistance Program, an agency in Washington, and they publish the state-by-state guidelines. There is some commonality across the federal level, and voters do use the same form across all states. What Overseas Vote Foundation has done is we've taken that form and all the different variations that the states have in terms of implementing the regulations, and we've automated that. So voting has really changed from overseas. We run 17 websites, and we've had over 3 million, actually over 3.5 million overseas visitors come to our site this year. Things have really changed, and they've changed through technology.
So basically, you can be a clearinghouse for information just as there are domestic clearinghouses where people can go and register to vote for every state. I mean, at this point, though, you know, there is a closing of the voter registration window. Most states are progressing to the point. Some you can register up to the very last minute, but many of them, some of them have already passed their voter registration deadline. So I'm assuming that depending on where the people living overseas are from, some of them may, if they haven't registered yet, it's just too late.
Well, that's true, but there are so many variations, as Mr. Sawyer was saying. It's really important that people don't take for granted that they can't vote. For example, if you are on the rolls as a registered voter, then you simply need to file the standard form as what's called a ballot request. And you might have up to election day to do that, which means you could get online in 10 minutes, have that form, fax it over, follow up by mail, and then the next day turn around and use the online ballot that we have and ship it over with FedEx. So all of these things are possible very quickly now with the use of technology. I really do want to emphasize that the paradigm has changed this year, and the result may be surprising.
Speaking of results, Mark, who's responsible for tallying up overseas votes? And, I mean, is it done in a timely manner?
Probably not. And that, again, that depends on state by state, county by county. The votes go to those places. And across the United States, there's a wide variation in how individual ballots are handled, what kind of ballots are handed out. So the thing is that people who are either displaced for various reasons, who are overseas, really have to be proactive about trying to make sure they get their vote in and getting their vote counted.
Susan, are you ever concerned, or does your group ever deal with the question of what happens to the votes once they're delivered?
Well, we're pretty familiar with the laws. And legally, every vote has to be counted, whether it comes from overseas or from next door to the election office. And we know that's the truth. Now, some ballots, may get counted later. Many states now have extended deadlines for receiving the absentee ballots from overseas. So if they're postmarked from overseas in time by Election Day, they can still arrive at the election office for sometimes up to 2 weeks after the election, but they are counted. Every single major election year, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission does what they call an Election Day survey, although the results come out far after Election Day. And at that point, every county is required to report up on how many requests they received for absentee overseas ballots, how many of those they sent out, how many were returned deliverable or returned voted, and how many were returned undeliverable, how many were rejected. So this is a law. I mean, it is a requirement. I'm dismayed, and I know a lot of voters are dismayed from all the rumors that their votes don't get counted. That I frankly don't believe it.
What would you like to see change, if anything, in the policies and the way this overseas voting is run?
What we'd like to see is that all states have the same requirements. Right now, you might have a couple that live together. They both vote in different states for the very reason that they both moved from different states. You vote as an overseas voter in the last state you lived in. So that's your last voting residence address. And that's the address you use when you register. Well, the variation in requirements between those two states, although it's the same voting program, it might be quite different. You might have extra questions in some states. Now, fortunately, we've programmed all that into our website at overseasvotefoundation.org, but still, there's a benefit to some uniformity. So making those laws really uniform in their implementation at the state level, that would be an advancement forward. And then unifying the way that ballots and voting materials can be transmitted. Right now, in one state, you might be able to receive a blank ballot by email, which cuts weeks off the delivery time, depending on where you are. But in another state, it might be just paper. For example, New York, paper only. They won't even take a fax.
That is kind of an unusual state to think of doing that. But we're going to have to let you go. But, of course, we're going to link to your information from your organization on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. So thank you.
Thank you.
That was Susan Jaduszewska-Swina. She's the president of a nonpartisan voter service, the Overseas Vote Foundation, and she was speaking to us from Munich, Germany. So, Mark, we're still here with you, and I want to talk a little bit more about what you think the government might do, what policy options could be to make sure that votes were counted sooner. And one of the things that's come up, or that's coming up in our series on voting, is just this whole idea of the uniformity or lack thereof of ballots. I mean, there's, you know, when there were controversies, we saw that there were hanging chads, there were punch card ballots, there's ballots with levers, there's people literally putting things on paper. You know, it's like everything but spray paint seems to be happening in some part of the country. And so how could, do you think it would be a good idea to make things more uniform? Because Susan was just telling us about all the different ways that overseas voters have to deal with things.
It's a brilliant idea, and it's really fundamentally a civil rights issue, and always has been ever since the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which stepped in to try and say that there at least had to be some guidelines, federal guidelines the states had to meet in order to make sure that they weren't disenfranchising large portions of their citizenry. At the same time, there's been some creep and the idea that rules vary so wildly across counties, across states, means that people really have to be very proactive and knowledgeable about how to get in, how to vote, and how to make sure their vote gets counted. And it does matter. We can look at data and see that in different localities, different amount, your likelihood that your vote is going to be valid and counted varies wildly given what kind of machine they have, the kind of whether or not they have sufficient ballots at polling places. All of those things are not standardized and are left to very small local officials and offices. We've seen the recent controversies in Ohio and Michigan about new voters, and then in Michigan about people who'd been foreclosed on. And those are really broad and difficult interpretations of rules that affect a lot of voters.
Well, of course, voters overseas aren't the only ones who might be forced to vote away from home. There's people who had to leave their homes following Hurricane Ike. We actually spoke to Tina Leverett. She's an elections administrator in Orange County, Texas, and here's what she told us about the changes being made there.
If they're a registered voter in Orange County and they're misplaced somewhere living outside the county, they can call into our office and we can send them an application to vote by mail, and they can send that back. And when we receive it back, we will send them a ballot. For early voting, we had to change one of our early voting election sites because literally almost all the houses in Bridge City were flooded out. And for election day, we've had to combine six of our election day boxes because they were flooded out.
Mark, in a second, we're going to talk with someone who actually has had to relocate. But just briefly, what do you think of the plans that Ms. Leverett outlined?
Well, it sounds like they're doing the best they can. The problem is you have people who are displaced. They're dealing with the sort of exigencies of daily life, trying to put their lives back together. And it's tough for them to figure out a way. A lot of them, people don't know where they are. And so it's tough for them to get that information, and voting may not be their top priority at the moment. And no one's making it easy for them, as you heard. You know, voting places are being moved around. There's all these things. So people really are going to have to, who are in those kinds of situations, are going to have to take positive steps. And that's the general thing in America, is that people have to take really positive and active steps to be able to vote.
All right. We've got someone with us who has been through the displacement. Robin Bouchong is a resident of Galveston, Texas, and she was forced to leave her home following the hurricane. How are you doing, Robin?
I'm surviving.
Yeah, I can
We're
only
surviving.
Imagine. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I'm sure you have a lot of other things on your mind and things to do. So how important in the whole list of things that you have to deal with is making sure that you vote in this election?
Well, personally, voting is very important. But I must tell you that probably for a lot of people in Galveston, we, as you may know, 75% of the homes, apartments in this on this island were flooded. And many, many are uninhabitable. So many of us, we personally, my husband and myself and dogs and cats, have moved now three times in 35 days.
Wow.
Hotel in Houston and hotel in Galveston, and now we are in a, fortunately, in a condominium of friends of ours while our home was rebuilt. So we're sort of looking at some sense of normalcy, but we have so many people on this island who are still in Red Cross shelters, who don't have a place to live, that are having to move off the island. So, you know, for us personally, yes, we will vote. But a lot of people, at least in this island of 57,000 people, I feel confident it's not a priority. They may not have registered. And to say that you have to register, you know, things are sent to you by mail. We personally right now have to drive 30 miles round trip just to get mail.
Right. Does it make you sad that there are not more? I mean, do you feel that the response is adequate? When you talk about driving that far just to get your mail, do you think that there should be other means of outreach to people from Galveston who are displaced, or is this just the way it has to be?
Well, having personally never gone through this before, thankfully we've had, you know, times that we've had to evacuate during Hurricane Alicia in 83. That was a Cat 3 storm, which wasn't 1/100th of what we, in my opinion, of what we've endured with this. They have now compared Ike with the 100-year storm, which, as you know, happened in Galveston on September 8th of 1900. So, you know, to say could FEMA or could the government be doing more, we're a resilient group. We try to get out and, you know, look after ourselves and be responsible. Obviously, with the severe housing shortage, again, and people displaced, some of the teachers, for example, now that the schools reopened, I believe it was on the 7th of October, are living maybe 2 hours away and having to commute.
Okay. I want to bring Mark in because just to give us a little bit more perspective. I mean, when you're hearing Robin talk about what she has to deal with and what folks have to deal with, what do you think could be done to make things simpler for voters at this critical time?
Well, I mean, one thing would be to have national rules. Another thing might be to decouple certain kinds of local elections from the national elections, such that people would be available to vote in national elections and could vote from, you know, generally someplace in the state. She hasn't left the state, so therefore she wouldn't affect the sort of Texas electoral ballot. But other things could just be done in terms of, you know, making sure that we know where people are. Maybe you might have a sort of national voter ID or a national voter registration roll that people would be on and enrolled in. So that way we could track them. We would know where they are. And even if she had to vote in some other locality, they could make sure that her ballot ended up where it needed to be.
Well, for one thing, most people, you know, and again, I'm just speaking specifically about Galveston, we have no landlines. The storm hit September 13th, and 90% of the island still has no landlines.
Right.
So if you don't have a cell phone, you can't communicate. We have very, very limited internet access. If you don't have a Verizon or AT&T air card, you have no internet access. And since so many people lost at least one automobile, you know, my husband and I are down now to one car because we haven't had a chance to go someplace, you know, to replace one of them. So everything takes so much time to get anything done right now that if people, I just, you know, I hope I'm wrong, but honestly, that date is going to come up on us and we're going to say, oh, is that election day?
Okay.
You know, it's just...
I have to stop you there, but
okay.
it's a really important point. And Robin, thank you and good luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you.
And thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Robin Bouchong. She was forced from her home on Galveston Island by Hurricane Ike, and Mark Sawyer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California in Los Angeles. He joined us at NPR West. And next, the silent gesture that reshaped sports 40 years ago. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Once again, it's a big week in sports, and NPR's Tony Cox is here to break down the latest. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, today is a significant day in Olympic sports history. 40 years ago today, track and field athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos made their famous silent gesture at the Mexico City Olympic Games.
1968 was an amazing year, and that's no small example.
You're exactly right. Two black gloved fists raised in the Black Power salute from the victory stand during an Olympic gold medal ceremony. It was one of the most memorable and explosive moments in sports history. Here's gold medalist Tommy Smith talking about that moment in a more recent interview with the BBC.
What I did is held my hand up in a cry for freedom. People call it black power. Of course I'm black. Of course we represented power. But it was a cry for freedom. Here, notice me. I'm in need. What are you in need of? Justice.
Today, Tommy Smith and John Carlos are being honored in Mexico City for their actions in 68, and we've asked David Steele to join us here to talk about that event and its impact. David is a sports writer for the Baltimore Sun, and he co-authored the autobiography of Tommy Smith called Silent Gesture. David, welcome.
How are you today, Tony?
Fine, thank you. Let's talk about this first. The human rights, the project, the Olympic Project for Human Rights, I believe that's the correct name of it. John Carlos and Tommy Smith were a part of that. What did it have to do with the protest?
It was begun on their campus. They were both students and runners at San Jose State University. And Dr. Harry Edwards, who's gone on to do so many great things since then, was the originator of it. And Dr. Edwards' original idea was to boycott the games and for the black athletes to make a statement for black America through that venue. And they decided by the time the games came along that they would sort of register their feelings and their protest in another way. But it began on campus and was stirred up by Tommy Smith and John Carlos, among other athletes there.
A lot of people may not know that the Australian who was on the stand with them, a white Australian named Peter Norman, who got the silver, wore an Olympic Project for Human Rights badge. He was a part of the protest also, wasn't he?
Absolutely, you know, and in the very famous picture, which is on the cover of the book and on hanging on so many walls all over America and all over the world, you can see the badge on Peter Norman's chest during the medal ceremony. He was the silver medalist, and the three of them remained friends for life. But the way that developed as they were walking toward the stand that night in Mexico City after the race, Peter Norman asked if he could wear a button and be part of what they were doing, and they immediately agreed. And he believes so strongly in that him being a part of it caused him problems back in Australia from the government and society as well. So he was a bigger part of that protest as the other two.
What I remember about seeing that and comparing it, in fact, to the O.J. Simpson trial, it was as if white America was appalled and black America was happy. What happened to Smith and Carlos when they got back after being expelled from the Olympics by the Olympic Committee?
It was a very harsh welcome back to the United States, back to San Jose. The immediate reaction, there was a lot of booing in the stands, and there was a demand that they remove their medals and throw them out. The Olympic Committee did expel them. They did get to keep their medals. But they were ostracized on campus. There were death threats constantly, and they were receiving death threats before the games as well. But it obviously intensified afterwards, and they really had to more or less go into hiding, even though they wanted to continue their studies and really continue to be athletes as well. And it really affected their lives deeply on a personal and professional level, even to this day.
One of the things that was odd was some of the other athletes who were black who were at the Olympics at that time did not participate in that. Talk briefly what the impact of that was. I'm thinking now, I believe George Foreman was there in 68. I hope I'm correct about that. And I
You're
remember seeing him holding the American flag at the same time.
Yeah, that happened after the protest. And there were several events, obviously, that black athletes were participating in before that there at the Games. And in track and field, as a matter of fact, several gold medals had already been handed out. And all of them had the option of making some sort of statement, and they all decided not to for various reasons, largely because they feared the backlash that they would have on them personally and how they'd be viewed by other Americans and others within athletes, because they wanted to protect their careers and futures. George Foreman was actually handed the that American flag after winning his gold medal in boxing by his coach, who was vehemently against the things that Tommy Smith and the other members of the Olympic Project for Human Rights were standing for. So George Foreman, and he's admitted this later on, was sort of unwittingly part of that, and he waved it in the ring, and he became an American icon. And he's said since then that when he came back to the United States, he thought he would be the hero among black Americans, and he found out that he was the outcast, and that Tommy Smith and John Carlos, among black Americans, were the heroes.
So here we are 40 years later. John Carlos, Tommy Smith are about to be given the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. In fact, they were given that at the ESPYs and are being honored again in Mexico City on the 40th anniversary. Do they say, if you've been in touch with either of them, do they say that it was all worth it as they look back?
They've always said it's been worth it, and they've suffered some terrible trials and personal setbacks. The death threats, not just to themselves but to their families, their careers have been affected, their livelihoods have been affected. Both of them have had to move around several times, and they've even had their own personal struggles with each other. But during this year, when receiving the ESPYs and in making appearances all over the country to talk about what happened 40 years ago and to look toward Beijing just this past summer, they've come together and talked about how they've had no regrets. If they had the opportunity, they would do it again. And if anybody today was so inspired to do the same thing, they would highly encourage it.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
David Steele is a sports writer for the Baltimore Sun, and he co-authored the book Silent Gesture, the autobiography of Tommy Smith. He joined us from the studios of the Baltimore Sun. Turning now, though, to our regular sports commentator, New York Times columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Mr. Roden.
The great, once again, Tony Cox.
It's nice to have you back. We're going to talk about baseball and football, but first, really briefly, what do you remember about that incident in 68, and what impact do you think it had on sports over the years?
I'll never forget that. I was sitting around. I was a freshman at Morgan State University as a football player, and we were sitting around after practice watching that race. And it's like it happened yesterday. We were sitting around watching, and after the race, these two great sprinters, and we were all sort of watching the the ceremony. And man, when they went up there, the national anthem went off, and these guys put their heads down, the fists up, you could hear a pin drop.
You sure could.
In that room. Our mouths were opening, and what it did for me personally, Tony, it really defined and focused me in on the struggle and what, as an athlete, I could do, and also just on integrity and courage. I think those are things that have never left me. And Tommy and John, I've got to know them and know them well. They are what Jackie McLean called American heroes.
It was a very, very intense, time. I remember it very well myself. All right, let's move on to talk about some current day sports. Let's go to baseball first. American League and National League Championship Series. One is over. One's almost over, it would appear. People were looking for the Red Sox and the Dodgers. That ain't gonna happen, Bill.
Yeah, speaking of Smith and Carlos, we could segue into Manny Ramirez. Because, he's sort of made a some people here in Boston will probably disagree, but the fact that he is not here in Boston and I think it really, really has colored this, the Red Sox chances. And sure, dramatically, we wanted to see the Dodgers and the Red Sox. That was sexy. The truth is that Manny, as great as he is, helped them get where they were, but he couldn't get them over the top because Philadelphia's just too good.
Yeah, better team, yep.
They're just a better team, and Boston, if anybody had any doubts about what he meant to them, he just basically pulled sort of a plug out of their hearts. And I'd be stunned if they would. I'd be stunned if they survived. If they survived the series, they won another game.
You think they? I don't think they'll win another game. Do you? You're up there.
It's, it's done. No, yeah, it's really over.
So are people going
really
to watch
over.
Before we move on to football? Are people willing to watch on television the World Series between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Tampa Bay Rays?
It's going to be a tough sell, Tony. I mean, it's going to be very good baseball. But in terms of the sexiness of it, I think that it's just going to be tough. It's really going to be tough.
All right. Let's talk about some things happening over on the people who play on Sundays. Football in the NFL been kind of crazy this season. At the start of the season, Bill Roden, most experts were saying the elite teams were the Patriots, the Colts, the Chargers, the Cowboys, maybe even the Jaguars. Now we're a little more than a quarter of a way through the season, and man, things have really changed. New England 3-2, having lost their last game. The Colts trying to pick themselves up from a dismal start. A lot of average records out there. Tennessee 5-0. Even the G-men, your beloved New York Giants, got their butts kicked last weekend, although they are still at the top of their division.
Yeah, I think in a weird way, my beloved Giants, by the way, Tony, I do think that the door is wide open for the New York Jets to go to the Super Bowl and actually to face the New York Giants. I think right now those two teams, with the addition of Tennessee, are the best teams in football right now. Even though the Giants lost, I think that was a trap game and they fell into it. But I think that those two teams are really the two best teams. I think, like I said, Tennessee is good. Kerry Collins, I still think that the jury is out. And what better guy to have on the bench in case Kerry Collins gets hurt than a humbled and refocused Vince Young?
Well, you know, that was, I was going to ask you about quarterbacks because, you know, the elite quarterbacks have been, over the last few years, you know, Tom Brady, Brett Favre, Roethlisberger. Are we seeing a changing of the guard with some of these new young quarterbacks coming in? I mean, I'm thinking about the kid in Atlanta, Matt Ryan, who played a terrific game last week.
Matt Ryan has been tremendous. A changing of the guard, I'm not sure. You know, you've got Ryan, obviously, and Philip Rivers. It's tough. Drew Brees. You're seeing a new wave of the same style. So in that extent, but still, I think that the best quarterback out there is Favre. He's come to New York, and although we've got a ways to go, he's just working magic.
Yeah, but he can throw six touchdowns 1 week and six interceptions the next week, can't he?
He hasn't thrown the six yet.
Not yet.
He hasn't thrown the six interceptions yet.
We'll have to wait and see. Here's our last topic before we get out of here. We've got a little bit more than a minute to go. Adam Jones, in trouble again. I don't know what to say about him and how many opportunities the NFL is going to give this Dallas football player for getting back into the game when he keeps messing up over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's a real tough situation, Tony. And it's one of those things where he put himself in a very awkward position where now the Dallas Cowboys give him their security detail, and I'm still waiting to find out what happened. Something happened that you're out with your own a company-hired security detail, and did you talk back to him? Did you say, listen, get out of my face? Something happened, but the bottom line is that he put himself in this position. He's going to have to pay the price for it, and it's unfortunate. Maybe this will open his eyes a little more.
Well, one of the things that's being said about him, because he's been in trouble so many times, is that what got him by before was his ability to play on Sunday and how well he played. This season, he hasn't played so well, so that makes it even harder for him when he gets in trouble again, doesn't it? I got about 10 seconds for you to say, for you to agree with me.
Yes. Yes, Tony, I agree with the great Tony Cox.
That's why we love having you on the show. Bill Roden, thank you very much. William C. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. He spoke to us from the studios of WGBH Boston, where he is covering the Red Sox-Rays series.
And that was the inimitable Tony Cox of NPR. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
I am doing fabulously. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, as you can guess, letters about politics are stuffing our inbox. Dan McAfee in Roselle, Illinois, wrote in after he heard us discussing voter registration fraud reports. It concerned the Association of Community Organizers for Reform Now, or ACORN. He didn't like what our guest, political analyst and author, Earl Ofari Hutchinson, had to say about the reports. Dan wrote, "His dismissive attitude that the problem is isolated to one state and his defensive comment likening this to the one purported voter suppression of the GOP was out of line. This is probably one of the most important history-making elections of the century. Any problem in the system, regardless of which candidate it benefits, flies in the face of democracy."
Then we got a couple of letters about what's called the Bradley effect. It concerns voters who tell pollsters they're going to vote for a black candidate, but when it comes to casting a ballot, they switch their vote. David Clemens in Fort Worth, Texas, wrote us this. "I believe the Bradley effect is happening before the election. In 2008, with the economy in a shambles, two wars, and a very unpopular president, the Democratic candidate should be leading by double digits. I believe that is a sign of the Bradley effect and racism, either conscious or subconscious."
But Phil Rutledge in Franklin, Tennessee, had a different take on the discussion. Phil wrote, "I am tired of hearing negative comments about people not voting for Obama because he is black. What about all the people that are voting for him because he is black? Are they not just as wrong for voting because of race? I have never heard a news item on people voting for his race." Well, thanks to both of you for writing. We understand that the nuances of race are complex at best. Because of these many layers, our editorial staff has decided to do a month-long series on race in November. We hope you listen.
And finally, Colleen Shondell in Watauga, Texas, sent us some love. "I merely want to congratulate you on a very informative, interesting, and entertaining hour of radio. I enjoy hearing many points of views on many subjects on News and Notes. This is a very important hour for listeners at this time in our history. After listening to you and your guest, I feel more informed and more able to speak with clarity and knowledge on many subjects. Thank you."
And thank you for your letters. Please keep your comments coming.
Now NPR has a new way to chime in on our stories. Go to our program page at nprnewsandnotes.org and select a segment. There you can click on the comments link and write us your thoughts.
And you can still send us your gripes and praises by logging on to npr.org and clicking on Contact Us. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thanks, Fry.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.